Hi, my name is Dorian Liss, and I'm from a startup called Neurofit. I'm presenting data that was collected by a cast of characters, cast of thousands, including Rain Chen, who recently finished her PhD at Hong Kong University, Quinn Kennedy from Naval Postgraduate School, Phil Okafor from the Stanford School of Medicine, Li, a good friend and collaborator from NYU Shanghai, as well as Hong Kong University, and finally Maheen Adamson from Stanford Med, as well as the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center. So we'll talk today about visual tracking in the context of a historical kind of dichotomy between philosophical perspectives about tracking ability. So in the first chapter of the Ted Williams book, The Science of Hitting, there's a great interchange between Ty Cobb, who made kind of a wisecrack. He said, Ted Williams sees more of the ball than any man alive, suggesting that Ted Williams had some sort of supranormal visual capability, you know, which was gone on and they mythologized it and it became, you know, a classic tale. And Williams, using the best very reasoned argument that I'd heard, he said, what I had more of wasn't eyesight, it was discipline. And here's how he supported his argument. He said, look, I have 20/10 visual ability, which is good for the control population. It's above average, probably for the major leagues, but it can no way account for a .344 lifetime batting average and a .400 single season average, right? There's no way you can account for this performance with that visual skill level. So just using these as kind of ends of the continuum, what we wanted to do is take a look at the literature and the standing data on dynamic vision, right? These are the visual skills that allow you to track moving objects, or the visual skills that allow you to perceive motion, aspects of motion like direction and speed, and you know, everything you need to hit a baseball. So in the top figure at the left, I'm showing you an image of a classic physiological experiment performed by Terry Bayhoe, kind of a personal hero of mine. In the 80s, he devised an eye-tracking system that was head-mounted that allowed him to actually measure eye and head movements in real time using an analog system from professional players and compare that to control observers. And what he showed in that study is that there is substantial cross-subject variability in dynamic visual skill. He had just one professional athlete in that sample, and what he showed was that there was a shorter response latency for the professional and better eye-head coordination, as well as individual reliable inter-subject differences. So this is the idea that people, you know, person to person, they process motion differently. It's quantifiable. Pros in this kind of foundational study do better at visual tasks, visual eye-hand tasks, oculomotor tasks than controls. So dynamic visual acuity was reviewed in a National Research Council report, and I've included links to anything that I can freely distribute. So if you get the slides, there's a really great kind of long research article on dynamic visual acuity where the National Research Council concluded that, quote, dynamic visual acuity is often more predictive of real-world tasks than static acuity. And the tasks that they used were driving and piloting aircraft. And people have gone on to quantify eye movement-based metrics of visual processing and how they can distinguish skill levels in sports, so like expert versus novice and so on. So this has been shown in both cricket batting and tennis, as well as baseball now. So one point I would leave you with is that standardized assessment methods for dynamic visual skills have not been adopted yet. There is no current standard, although we're hoping to kind of contribute to that effort. So I want to go through three separate experimental questions today. The first is basically a population-based set of questions. Do professional athletes show visual motor performance that's superior to control subjects? Of course, we'd all expect that they do. But when you compare them with other populations, you can start to address and answer questions about by what mechanism? By what mechanism are pro athletes better than controls? And then what are the mechanisms, the underlying, you know, population differences that contribute to these differentiations that we see? Second, are visual tracking skills largely inherent, or have they been modified by experience? This is the Ted Williams versus the Ty Cobb dichotomy. And then third, how are visual tracking skills related to eye-hand motor skills like batting? And in this part, I'll refer to an extremely comprehensive data set collected by Rain Chen in Li's lab at NYU. So this is the task that we use. It's a standardized task that's designed to assess dynamic aspects of vision, including many traditional properties of the smooth pursuit response, which is the tracking response that allows you to stabilize the image of a moving target on your retina, and then also saccadic movements, which are quick flicks of the eye that allow you to compensate for any deficits in the tracking response. So you might have missed it, but there were three little trials that showed up in that little facsimile of the stimulus on the right. So it's a little jerky there, right, on the projector. But what you can see is a motion signal that shows up that's completely unpredictable in both time, direction, and speed. So what we're trying to do is minimize the high-level expectancies that the observer can bring to the task and just measure exactly how well does the observer transduce the sensory signal that shows up on the screen, process that, you know, through areas V1, MT, and MST, and then use that output to drive the eyes to follow the stimulus. So here are data. This is what we call our summary figure of our 5-minute task. So on the left, I'm showing you a summary figure from the control observer, and on the right is a summary figure from a pro baseball player, an athlete from one of the Hong Kong national teams. So there are a couple things you'll see here. So on the left, I'm showing you basically histograms of the outcomes of many different types of oculomotor measures on several types of trials. So latency is the amount of time it takes for the observer to respond to the moving stimulus. Acceleration is how long does it take the observer to get their eye moving up to the target velocity. Gain is the ratio of eye velocity to target velocity. This can be very high in professional athletes and tends to be lower in the control population. Saccadic amplitude, so when the observer lags behind the stimulus and needs to catch up, how large are those saccadic movements that would perturb your perception of the moving stimulus and degrade your ability to hit a ball? And then finally, proportion smooth, which is one of my favorites because it came up, I made it up. It's a displacement ratio similar to gain, except it's for displacement. So how much of the eye displacement is actually comprised of smooth pursuit versus the saccadic response? And that's a good estimate of how well the person can perceive and respond to a smoothly moving stimulus. So these are individuals. On the right-hand column, what I'm showing you is scatter plots of pursuit direction as a function of target direction. And this is basically around the unit circle. If the tracking were perfect, right, this would be a straight line along unity with no variance. You can see clearly there's a lot of scatter in the directional tuning for the control subject. There's much less scatter for the professional baseball player. What this means is that everybody misperceives direction slightly. I mean, I think Andy McKay said it best when he said, we're all humans. Nobody is the same on a day-to-day basis, and it's also true that nobody is the same on a trial-by-trial basis, right? We misperceive above and below the direction, we misperceive above and below the speed, and this is all quantifiable, right, with the noise levels that you can see in both direction and speed tuning. So on the bottom, you can see I'm plotting pursuit speed as a function of target speed. What you'd hope to see here, right, is a nice steady slope, right, maybe a gain of 0.8 or 0.9 for responsiveness with very little noise. You can see that both the control subject and the professional athlete have substantial variability on a trial-by-trial basis. The control subject is much less able to perceive differences in speed as measured by eye movements than the pro baseball player. So these are just two individuals. Here are what the distributions look like. So histograms of these metrics for the control population as well as the pro baseball population. This is a nice data set that Rains collected. 47 control subjects. Age and gender match to the 44 pro baseball subjects. What you can see is that there's a tendency for the initiation metrics for pro baseball players to be faster. So they've got 10 or 15 more milliseconds to work with than the control population. Accelerations are higher. Steady state gain is higher. Saccadic amplitude is lower. Proportion of smooth tracking is higher. And there's much less noise in direction and speed, and the speed responsiveness, that is, the ability to perceive and respond to small changes in speed is also higher in professional athletes. So what we do, because this is a high-dimensional vector, we take this 10-dimensional space and we distill it into a single discriminant, which we call NFIT, which is our visual tracking score. So you can think of it as a Z-value, reference to the control population, that gives you a sense for how above average a particular person may be. So I've given this the atomic number 101, right, which would put it in the lanthanide and actinide series, right? This is one of the metrics that can be measured in a lab, but you'll never see it out on the field, right? I'll go into a little more about that later. So this is our infant net metrics for the control population, the baseball study. Clearly, there's a nice, you know, Gaussian-shaped distribution, which I've overlaid with a solid fit. When you take the baseball population, you superimpose it, clearly they're better than average, but they're better than average with less variance, which is a point I'm going to come to in just a second. Also, I'm just going to bring your attention to that far rightmost point, the best performer in the data set. The best performer in this case in the data set didn't come from the pro baseball distribution. They came from the control distribution, right? So this would have been one of the 47 control subjects recruited out of Hong Kong University who, for some reason, was better than all the professional baseball players in the sample. How did this happen? So these are our disease populations. So we've measured data from traumatic brain injury, from a complication of liver disease called hepatic encephalopathy, and finally from Parkinson's disease. So these people, as you might imagine, they all show impairments relative to the control population, but they show impairments relative to the control population with added variance, right? So the variance in these disease populations is always larger than the control population, which is consistent with the idea that the severity of the disease contributes variance to our estimates of visual tracking ability. So if you imagine like the population in general is kind of a continuum, right? So you have people on the left who come from brain injury populations, encephalopathy populations, or people with neurodegenerative disease, right? They'll be impaired. You have your professional athletes on the right. You have people who have, you know, engage in sensory motor training, like video gamers who may have increased performance as well. And if we take our control population, we consider those to be people from the unit normal distribution with mean 0, variance 1, we can then compare. Our athletes on the right and our disease populations on the left, and we can start to test hypothetical underlying mechanisms of how those populations came to become differentiated. So here's a possibility for you. Here's our control distribution on the left. Let's imagine we take this control distribution and everyone gets a mild concussion. This shifts the distribution one half of a z-value, for example, to the left with no added variance because this, you know, hypothetical mild brain injury was exactly the same for everybody, right? And then you can, you know, hypothetically shift it even further to the left, and that gives you basically a leftward shift with no added variance. Now, of course, no two diseases are exactly the same severity, so the increased variance that we see in the disease populations could be consistent with the idea that there is, you know, an added noise factor that stems from the severity of the disease, right, in addition to, you know, the disease, it's the presence or absence of the disease itself is a binary factor. So that's very different than what we see in the athletes, of course, right? So here's a model of an underlying statistical selection mechanism whereby you take a control distribution, right, let's say two high school teams, you take the best infit value from those two high school teams, and then that gives you a resulting selection, right? So you get a new distribution which is shifted to the right, but it's shifted to the right with less variance and also some skew. So that's one round of selection I'm showing. I'll just step back and forth so you can see what that looks like. And then if you go to two rounds of selection, right, you're going from something that's centered at, I don't know, 0.7 or so to something that's centered at about a Z value of 1 with even less variance. So this is an underlying mechanism that can account for the above average visual tracking metrics in professional athletes, and also the fact that if you sample a wide enough control distribution, you'll find people who are even better than professional baseball players. So this is kind of consistent with the idea that visual tracking is, as Cobb suggested, perhaps an inherent visual skill. So what I'm showing you here is just the variance of each of our distributions. So our disease distributions in red, plotted on the y-axis as a function of the mean of that distribution. So of course our control observers are all at mean of 0, variance of 1. All the disease populations have added variance, and the pro baseball populations all have less variance than the controls. Right? This is consistent with an additive type model with some added variance for the disease players, the disease populations, and then a selection model for the pro players. So clearly we see visual motor performance is superior to control subjects, and there seems to be an underlying selection mechanism that's at play in pro baseball players, and that definitely differs from our disease populations. So these are the best data points I can show you about that test the hypothesis whether visual tracking is an inherent skill. So the first one is the one I've already talked about. The variance in the baseball population is smaller than the control population, consistent with the selection model. Second, for some reason, if you sample widely in the control distribution, you'll find people who have supranormal dynamic visual abilities, even better than pro athletes. That should not happen if this is a training effect. And then lastly, in the professional sample that we had, there was actually a wide variety of years of experience. So some of the people were veteran athletes, other people were fairly new to the team, and sometimes even the sport. And if you look at the correlation between the visual tracking index as a function of experience, we see absolutely no correlation. So that R value is zero. This is the best test of the hypothesis that visual tracking ability in pro athletes is modified by experience. There's no signal there. So are the visual tracking skills largely inherent, or have they been modified by experience? It seems that they're largely inherent. Largely inherent in the sense that the most variance that we see in infit comes from the across-subject variance. And there is no effective experience that we have seen to date. Now, I want to back up and I want to bring our attention to the fact that, indeed, on a day-to-day basis, no person is the same, right? When we wake up in the morning, our nervous system is in a different state. We got different states of rest. We're under different amounts of stress or fatigue or whatever it may be, right? And these brain health factors ebb and flow all the time, you know, over the course of days and weeks and months. And clearly those that work in, for example, sports science or high-performance training, right, they're aware of these factors and they try to drive the effect of these factors to zero, mitigate the negative factors as much as possible. And this brings up the idea that, indeed, if you measure somebody's dynamic visual tracking ability, their brain health on a day-to-day basis, some of these factors may be influencing the day-to-day scores. They may introduce variability into the measurements, and it can actually account for some of the variance in day-to-day measurements for an observer. So what I tried to do in this slide is highlight that such variance does indeed exist. So as Andy McKay said in the player development panel, people are not the same on a day-to-day basis. And what I'm showing you here in this time series graph is our best attempt to quantify what that variance might look like. So what I'm plotting here is a self-referenced infit score from an individual over a 16-month period from August 2016 through December 2017. Each one of the high-frequency points is 1 5-minute infit score. And what I've done is I've superimposed a 30-day moving average as a solid blue line. And I've kind of pointed out a few annotated points in the data set. So the first one is an alcohol measurement, blood alcohol level of 0.02, that we took early in the data collection process. There was a series of measurements under stress, so there was a prolonged period of low performance at low frequency, which is kind of an interesting thing to see. It kind of makes me think back to the first panel that showed up, and Brian Kenny mentioned, how can you expect somebody who's going through a divorce to hit a ball that's coming at him at 100 miles an hour, right? You wouldn't expect that person could possibly perform under the same conditions, right? And that's consistent with the kind of low-frequency dip that I'm showing you there under stress conditions. And then finally, in March, we ran another alcohol experiment, another what we call beer experiment, where we took blood alcohol level to 0.03, and we sampled at 15-minute intervals around the time that experiment took place to show you the time course of what those data might look like. So the first three measurements, the black points on the right-hand side, show the baseline. And then as the alcohol started to kick in, the Z value for the infit.me score, the self-referenced score, dropped to -3, right, which is well outside the normal range for this observer. And then you can see that with the time course of the measurements that we took as the effect wore off, those points relaxed back to baseline with a time constant of about 1.16 hours. So based upon these data, what we've done is we've tried to estimate the within-subject variance to the across-subject variance, and we come up with a ratio of across-subject to within-subject variance of about 10 to 1, right? So this kind of makes me refer back to what Vince Gennaro mentioned about 80% of the potential of a player being basically largely inherent and 20% being trainable. And as far as we can tell, with this particular metric that we're looking at that you can use to assess potential, that's about a 90 to 10 split, right? Within subject is about 10%, cross subject is the rest of the 90%. So lastly, how are visual tracking skills related to eye-hands motor skills like batting? Well, here I'm gonna refer to this incredible data set collected by Rain Chen in Dr. Li Li's lab, where she took a sample of professional baseball players and age match controls. She ran them on three standardized tests. One is the visual tracking test that we're familiar with. The second is a manual control task, that is the ability to track randomly moving motion, unpredictable motion with the joystick. And finally, kind of a controlled infield batting task, where she took a series of sequenced pitches, ran them through a pitching machine, and then looked at hit rates and contact rates in her professional athlete population. So that's Rain Chen. And here's what the control distribution looks like. So what I'm plotting here is manual control index as a function of visual tracking index for her control distribution. You can see that there's a little bit of correlation there, maybe borderline significant, but not much. When you get to the professional athletes, however, these people who hit baseballs for a living have learned somehow to harness the visual tracking capability in a way that's much more tightly correlated than the control distribution, right? So this is consistent with the idea that control observers, right, they don't need to maximize their sensorimotor performance, their job performance doesn't depend on it. But when you get to athlete populations, these people are better able to harness their inherent vision motor capabilities in order to drive their motor system to perform on tasks like manual control and also batting. So this is what the overall distribution looks like. So for all subjects, we see a correlation of about 0.52 between the manual control index and visual tracking, which is consistent with the idea that these manual control skills they share variance with visual tracking potential. So considered as an overall population, there's a nice visual manual correlation, but we don't really care about manual control, do we? We care about batting, right? So this gives us kind of a theoretical construct to work within. So the idea here with this nice correlation is that there is a theoretical maximum in eye-hand ability, in eye-hand skill that an observer can achieve with a particular level of dynamic visual acuity, right? So if they're off the charts, right, if they're some sort of legendary, dynamic visual performer, then they have a higher capacity, a higher potential to achieve dynamic visual performance on eye-hand tasks. And this is what we call the eye-hand axis, right? This is the correlation that you would expect to observe in the most seasoned athletes that basically shows you what performance looks like as a function of potential when potential has, or performance has basically asymptoted, right? When athletes live up to their inherent neural processing capabilities and potential. So these are effects of experience. One of these I mentioned already, where you look at visual tracking index as a function of experience of years in this pro population. No effect there, right? That's an R value of 0.01. But for the manual control tasks, right, for motor tasks that we largely know to be trainable, there are positive R values. For manual control index, this is 0.18 as a function of experience. So these people are improving, maybe on a borderline level with experience. And then finally, when you get to batting, which is the metric we all care about, there's a borderline significant effect even within this small population. Right, so we all know that to be trainable. We know there are aspects of batting that are clearly developing over the course of a player's career, which is consistent with this correlation here. So if you look in the pro players at the least experienced cohort, these are the people with 10 or fewer years of experience in the pro leagues, there's a basically random scatter. There's not very much structure in this cloud at all. So these people look in many ways like the control distribution that I showed you in the previous graph. However, when you look at the most experienced players in this cohort, there's an extremely strong correlation, a correlation which across subject is stronger than anything I've seen to date. This is consistent with the idea that these players who have spent time honing their skills and, you know, practicing, you know, getting their nervous systems under control in numerous at-bats, they've actually achieved this tight correlation that you would predict from this eye-hand axis, right? They are performing up to their potential. Now, you'll notice there's a small cohort of inexperienced players to the right that seem to be underperforming their potential. They're falling below the eye-hand axis. And if you were, for example, to find these players early in their development, right, you might notice that they're not performing up to their inherent visual potential, it seems. You might try to assess the problem, you know, give them a little bit more support in batting and those kinds of things. And the hypothetical question here, right, the question that we're really interested in is, will these players, as they gain more experience, as they, you know, they learn to train their eye-hand system, as they learn to get their nervous system under control, will they indeed take their place at the top right-hand portion of this distribution? That's kind of a player development question. So here what I'm showing you is the ability to predict batting performance for both visual tracking and manual control. These are our two separate assessment tasks as a function of years of baseball experience. And clearly there's a nice effect here. So if you look at everyone in the cohort, so 3 years of experience or more, there's a very weak correlation there. In fact, it's not even significant if you look at everyone together. But as you filter the cohort for the most experienced people, that correlation becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, consistent with the idea that these people are learning to realize their potential and they're kind of maximizing their eye-hand skills up to the asymptote, right, the asymptotic performance predicted by the eye-hand axis. So these two metrics that can assess different aspects of sensory motor performance are both predictors of batting ability, whereas manual control performs at an R value, predictive value of about 0.44 in the most seasoned cohort. Our visual tracking index gives you an R value of about 0.085. So just to summarize here, how are visual skills related to eye-hand motor skills like batting? Clearly, all aspects of eye-hand performance, including manual control, correlate with visual tracking. Right? These are all shared skills driven by your ability to process visual motion. Our data are consistent with the idea that eye-hand skills, all eye-hand motor coordination skills, develop to within visual limits. And that's the kind of theoretical idea that we're exploring. So if you take, you know, this idea of a batting index that will develop over time, and you were to hypothetically take a cohort of inexperienced players, right, you'd expect Gaussian distribution of visual tracking, right, people with low experience, you wouldn't expect much correlation with batting ability, right, because their motor systems, their sensory motor systems have not yet been trained. However, with experience, you'd expect the people with the highest potential would increase fastest, and the people with the highest potential would increase up to the level of performance predicted by the eye-hand axis if, for example, you were to scan, you know, a pro league team and get a good sense for what that regression line should look like. So this is you know, the eye-hand axis prediction, and it also relates to the two philosophical positions that we talked about right in the outset. So Ted Williams made an argument that what he had more of wasn't eyesight, and definitely wasn't eyesight in the 2010 static visual acuity sense. Although there is a strong possibility that Ty Cobb had made an prescient observation, right, that actually his dynamic visual acuity and his batting potential was indeed largely supernormal, right? It may have been as mythologically amazing as people think it might have been, right? And this is consistent with the idea that there is an x-axis of potential, consistent with what Vince was talking about yesterday with the 3x3 grid. This is almost exactly the same idea, that there is an x-axis of inherent visual skill that can be developed over time, which is the y-axis, right? The axis of performance, which, you know, here I'll just label as the Williams axis of discipline, whereby, you know, with repeated exposure to the plate, approaching the plate with a plan, all of the skills that seasoned batters develop, they might, you know, over time learn to kind of harness their inherent visual ability and then hit the level of performance predicted by the eye-hand axis. So just to kind of summarize here, Clearly, we know pro baseball players have better visual motor capabilities than non-athletes. We know populations with brain disease show impairments. The mechanisms of differentiation allow us to test mechanistic hypotheses. So pro athletes show less variance than controls. Disease populations show more variance. And then finally, visual tracking skills for both visual tracking and manual control are predictive of batting performance, with visual tracking being the stronger predictor. These ideas support the idea that there is a batting performance limit, right, that may be inherently set by the ability to process motion, which is measurable using standard paradigms. So I'd just like to thank all the participants in this set of studies, most specifically all the men's and women's players from the Hong Kong national teams, the coaching staff from the national teams, our disease populations, and then Lita, Stefanos, Rami, and Dimitri from NeuroFit. And also finally, thank you all for your kind attention through the very last research presentation of the meeting. Questions, discussion?
Yeah, the world pinball champion is autistic, and one of the reasons he's so effective is because he can track multiple pinballs at the same time.
Right.
Have you done any study with the autistic population?
It's a fascinating question. I wonder whether it's motion processing or focus, you know, because autistics also have legendary focus. The data I've seen to date have shown apparent impairments in motion processing for autistics. It's a really fascinating disease question, really topical. I don't have a great answer for you, but it doesn't seem to be motion processing according to the data I've seen thus far.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
The NFIT versus time chart that you showed, where you explained some of the dips in the chart.
Sure.
It looked like there might have been a little bit of a cyclical thing going on there. Do you see any kind of cyclical relationship, and is there any explanation for the peaks?
That's a great question. There's a lot of power at low frequency. There's a lot of nice autocorrelation that you could work with. So from like a sports science perspective, there's a lot of power at ones of months, so like 3 or 4 weeks. I've looked for circadian stuff. That's difficult to pull out with this data right now. Kevin Tenenbaum from the Indians mentioned weekly cycles. That's a possibility. I haven't seen that strongly in this data set yet. But again, we haven't really been disciplined enough to measure it on literally a day-to-day basis over the course of the 18 months that we'd really need to find those signals. Because clearly there's a lot of low-frequency dips and ebbs and flows in components of brain health that we need to account for and subtract out. Thank you for bringing that up. Oh, yeah. There could be. Sure, there could. So in NFIT, what we think we're mostly measuring is inherent. So I don't know that there would be a visual training task, for example, that would be expected to improve NFIT. However, right, if you measure NFIT on a day-to-day basis, it's difficult to rule out the idea that what you're really doing, right, to improve NFIT, even before or after other types of training, is you're paying more attention to nutrition, you're paying more attention to rest, you're paying more attention to fatigue factors and stress, and all the things that we do a terrible job of managing in daily life, right, may actually be what's influencing NFIT on a daily basis. And my speculation based upon this graph is that the increases that you see from, for example, August to November 2016 all the way up through April, May, June 2017, right, is all brain health, right? That's all stress management, nutrition, rest, those kinds of things. So, I would tend to emphasize the brain health factors over training, but you could do a controlled study, right, where you take an NFIT measurement, you subject people to training, and then you assess again with NFIT to see if there's any, pre-post effect. And then that brings up time scale questions and, a whole host of other questions. Thank you.
I might observe that two of the points there of some interest are around Thanksgiving and St. Patrick's Day.
That's a very astute observation. I won't comment further. Thank you all.